So tonight I would like to talk on deconstructing the sense of self, or the five aggregates of clinging. This teaching on these five aggregates, or also called the five khandhas or the five categories of experience, is really one of the central teachings of the Buddha. And it can really open another way for us of perceiving and conceiving of ourselves. So a way that is freeing and liberating, and that can loosen certain fixed ideas that we have about ourselves. And of course, the sense of our personal identity is very central to our whole experience. Everything is being interpreted and understood with reference to me, to my person. We suffer so much when we feel that ourself is not being acknowledged or is being threatened or isolated, and we feel very happy when we feel that ourself is being acknowledged and receives love or praise. So ourself is really the main point of reference from which we look and view at the whole world. And in small children, we can see this very directly and very unmasked, this sense of I want this, I want that, and I want it immediately. And when this I doesn't get what it wants, it will react really strongly, maybe with aversion or sadness or so. So all our hopes, all our fears revolve around our sense of self. What will the future bring to me? Who will I be? What I like, what I don't like, my life, my body, my interests, my family. It's always about me. So on one level, of course, it's absolutely fine and healthy to have a sense of who we are, to have a personal identity on a conventional level. We all have a sense of who we are in terms of our name, our gender, age, ethnic group, personality, political views, and so on and on. And we couldn't live a normal life if we didn't have such an identity. It's just a necessary part of human development. And yet, if taken for too real and too solid, all these identifications can become a trap. They can imprison us and limit our growth and development, because they only allow certain behavior, certain thinking, certain acting. So framing all our experiences in the terms of this self, as much as it is conventional and normal, is at the same time very limiting, because it puts ourselves and the world into boxes and categories that define what is possible for us and what not. And as we are singling out this self, at the same time, actually in the same process, we also create the not self, the other, the world out there. And our relationship to this other, to the world, is very often marked by a basic sense of fear or uncertainty. And a loneliness that comes from being set apart from this world. And so also a feeling arises that I need to make sure that myself will be somehow safe in this world. So the sense of self and identity has its costs. It goes together with a fundamental unease and uncertainty, and with an urge to somehow keep this self safe and well. And this can become a dominant concern in our psyche, to take care of this self, to protect it. And while we can be very concerned about our own self, we do not care in the same way for the well-being of others. Just if you think of the person sitting next to you right now, I bet that their knee pain or their family problems will not affect you in the same way as your own knee problem or family problem, even if you are a really, really empathetic person. The fact that something is my pain or my problem gives it much more significance than if it's someone else's pain, especially if it is someone we might not even know. So the sense of self is what really creates the whole world, and it really determines what we experience. Now, if we can come to understand that this sense of self is actually a construction that has been fabricated by the mind without any real basis, we can develop a new relationship to this sense of self, to this identity. We can see it as a useful framework in some contexts that can be held more lightly, rather than believing in a fixed and solid self. And it is in this context, I find, that the teaching on the khandhas, on the aggregates, can be such a helpful way of seeing our experience, because it really highlights the process through which the mind actually constructs this sense of self, this identity. And the teaching offers an alternative way of conceptualizing our experiencing. So the central process involved here is the process of identification. We identify something to be me or mine. We grasp at it and we cling to it. This is who I am. This is how I am. This belongs to me. And then we identify something else to be not me. This is you. This is the other. These five aggregates are a way of deconstructing what we inadvertently have come to see as myself into five fundamental processes, making up our experience in any moment. Actually, the khandhas cover not only what I consider to be myself, but all phenomena in our experience, inner and outer, self or other. So we can analyze all our experiences into these five khandhas, and each khandha in itself is again a collection. The Pali word khandha means literally a heap or a pile, a bundle or a mass. So each khandha is not a solid entity in itself, but it is in itself, again, a collection of elements, of parts. So it's, as the name says, it's an aggregate. Yeah. And these five khandhas are, in short, the rupa khandha, which we could call the body group, which includes all the somatic and sensory dimensions of our experience, the Vedana khandha, the feeling tone group. I've spoken today about this hedonic tone being pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant. We have the Sanya khandha, the perception group that refers to all perceptual and cognitive processes. We have the Sankhara khandha, the so-called mental formation group that refers to emotions, intentions, motivations. And we have the Vijnana khandha, the consciousness group, that refers to the cognizing capacity of our mind, the capacity to have conscious experience, awareness, you could say. So sometimes it is said that the khandhas describe who we are, but this is actually misleading. It is more appropriate to say that they show who we are not. They describe what we identify with and what we take to be ourselves. So we constantly try to base our sense of self on any of those khandhas. By clinging to one of the khandhas in any moment, by identifying with it, a sense of self is being created. That's why the Buddha spoke of them as the clinging khandhas. And our mind is prone to constantly cling to one of the khandhas and to consider it me or mine. Maybe you get a sense of how dynamic this whole process really is. Rather than speaking of a fixed personality or a static self, these teachings describe an ongoing process of identification and self-creation. And it's a process that happens both intrapsychic and also interpersonal. So some of those identifications we create and construct ourselves, but we can also experience how other people categorize us and impose certain identities on us. Whatever the origin of those identifications, they can at times really become quite a burden. And the Buddha said about the khandhas that they are burdensome, and he compared them to bundles or bricks that each of us is carrying on our back. Sometimes we can really notice how onerous this burden feels. Just last week I was at a teacher meeting where I met many people for the first time. And I felt what I often feel when meeting new people and when they ask me about, you know, who are you, my story, where I come from, and so on. And then I say, yes, I'm living in Switzerland, and yes, my father was Japanese, and no, I don't speak Japanese, and so on and on. And telling my story, I feel bored. And there is a sense of this really not being that relevant, because it doesn't feel like what I really am. And yet I know it's just a conventional way of relating to each other. We like to put each other into boxes of gender, of nationality, of ethnic group, whatever, so that we feel like we actually know something about each other. It is just conventional friendliness to engage in these kinds of rather superficial exchanges. It's not bad or so, but we can somehow feel that knowing about all those identifications is not really touching what is essential about the person. Don't you feel that? It's not the essential dimension. We know it. So maybe you have experienced that for yourself, how this identity and this self-definition can become a burden at times. Each one of us has his or her own bundles, our self, our story, our ideas and opinions, our preferences, all that we identify with. And at times we may feel a longing to escape this prison of who I am, a longing to get in touch with a deeper dimension that is beyond all those boxes and categories. But we cling so much. We are so used to clinging that it really takes practice and trust to gradually soften the grip and to see all those identities as relative, conventional and changeable ascriptions. To the extent that we can let go of some of this clinging, we start to notice a sense of ease, of release. To the extent that we know the khandhas just as phenomena without owning them, there is more freedom in the mind. So let's go into the khandhas. The rupa khandha is the aggregate of body or matter or form. And as I said, it includes the somatic and sensory dimension of our experience. Form, rupa, refers to everything that we can perceive with our five senses. This includes our physical body and the objects in the environment. Form is what resists, what we can touch or hear, what falls apart, what occupies space. Forms have the characteristics that they interfere with one another, This all belongs to Rupa. And probably the most basic way how many people identify themselves is through the identification with the own body. Thus we say, this is my body, or I am my body. And dependent on how we evaluate this body, our sense of self-worth will be high or low, dependent on whether the body feels healthy or ill, whether it looks okay or not. It all has a direct implication on how we sense ourselves. The aggregate of form also includes the five sensory organs, the eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue, and the body, and the corresponding senses, visual, auditory, olfactory, the taste, and tactile objects. So whatever our sensory experience, it is all part of Rupa. For instance, right now, as you are aware of sitting, all those sensations that you are aware of right now, you know, the pressure in the buttocks, maybe the temperature that you feel, the movement of the breath, it all belongs to Rupa Kanda. And also here, very often we cling to the sensory perceptions, to what we see or hear. We feel like this is my perception, my felt sense in the buttocks, for instance. And traditionally also the four great elements are subsumed under this khanda, so earth, water, fire, and air, because they make up the physical world as we know it. The next khanda is the vedana khanda, the feeling tone, which, as you know, refers to this quality of any experience to be pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant. Some people call it the hedonic tone. And in spite of the feeling, the word feeling that is contained in this expression, Vedana does not refer to emotions or feelings. Sometimes that's being misunderstood, but it's rather the first spontaneous sense that we get in any sense contact, in any experience, actually. It is a mental process. Each of our sensory experiences is instantly and automatically experienced as pleasant or unpleasant. So many people will experience, for instance, the smell of lunch as a pleasant vedana. Without thinking about it, it just happens on a preconceptual level. And then a back pain, obviously unpleasant. Yeah. And there are many experiences that somehow fall in this middle range of neither pleasant nor unpleasant. Maybe if you are looking at, you know, the floor, might be in this middle range. But Vedana must not be same for each person all the time. It can actually change, and it is conditioned on many levels and in many ways. For instance, if you are feeling nauseous, then the smell of lunch will be very unpleasant to you and rather make you feel like you want to throw up. So it's not stable. So Vedana is constantly at work in any microsecond even of our experience, and it gives us like a primary and preconceptual evaluation of our experience. I find it interesting that the Buddha singled out Vedana as a known khanda, and really giving this dimension such an importance in the framework of the five khandas. I find that rather surprising. The reason I feel is that Vedana plays such an important role in the conditioning of our whole experience, because it determines whether we or any organism will move towards an object or away. Unless we reflect and we have maybe other considerations, and then we make maybe conscious choices, unless we do this, Vedana will really determine our behavior. So when we are not really mindful, when we are not aware, then we will live a life that is oriented towards maximizing pleasant Vedana and minimizing unpleasant Vedana. It can become really the basic criterion for people how to make choices in their life. And when we are not mindful, then pleasant experiences will immediately trigger craving, desire, wanting more. You know, you see some nice chocolate on the table and immediately there is this, oh, chocolate, I want to go and get, how many should I take? Yeah, immediately. And when it's unpleasant, it immediately triggers aversion or rejection. And this middle range of neither pleasant nor unpleasant triggers a kind of spacing out, not really interested in what I'm experiencing. So Vedana is not a problem in itself. From an evolutionary perspective, we might say that it gives an organism a first and very basic way of orienting itself in the world. I always imagine these very simple unicellular organisms that already have the ability to move towards the food and away from what doesn't feel okay for them, you know, what feels threatening. Even on this very simple level of life forms, there is already a basic orientation and evaluation. However, it becomes problematic if we construct a sense of self on this basis, if we identify with it. For instance, there are many people who don't like certain food. How easy is it then to move from, well, Brussels sprout is rather unpleasant, from this statement to, I'm a person who does not like Brussels sprout? Do you know that? All these identities that we have around food. Oh, it's extreme, you know, how much story we create around this. Thus, I define myself and it can become a really stable characteristic of myself. And this will make me much more resistant to maybe once go and again try Brussels sprout. Maybe, you know, my perception changes. Sometimes people find that it can change the perception, the taste. But because they are so in this identification, I'm someone who doesn't like it, they simply refuse any kind of food that contains this specific taste. Yeah. We also identify with Vedana when we define ourselves on the basis of how we are feeling. For instance, I find it interesting when I feel a lot of pleasantness in body and mind, then the mind easily creates, oh, I'm feeling really well. Oh, I am great. Yeah. And when I'm feeling not so good, when there is a lot of pain and difficult emotions, it impacts how I see myself based on Vedana. So we take Vedanas as something that defines who we are and we even evaluate ourselves on the basis of the Vedana that we are experiencing. And we just don't see how impersonal all this Vedana actually is. So I might feel energetic or tired due to many, many conditions which have nothing to do with me. And yet so often we make these connections and then we believe that these Vedanas have something to do with me. Vedana is dependent on so many conditions. Our biography, our cultural conditioning, what we ate yesterday, the temperature, I mean everything. You know, it's always a coming together of so many causes and conditions that leads to a certain Vedana. Okay, so then let's move on to the Sanya Khanda, which is a perception group. And actually, the translation perception does not do justice to all the processes included in this aggregate, because it actually includes all the perceptual and cognitive aspects of our experience, the way we make sense of our world. We categorize experiences, we label them, we recognize them, and we comprehend them all through sanya. Also, memory is based on sanya. So it's through sanya that we recognize, for instance, okay, there are people in here, there are windows, there is a tree out there. It all happens through connecting our sense experience with our memory, with the categories that we already know. We assimilate our experience into our frameworks. Actually, it's really lovely when you watch a small child that is just learning language, just the joy that children experience when they learn how to identify, oh, that's a dog, and that's a cat, and a car. So the mind likes to do this, to somehow grasp things through these concepts. So through this sanya, khanda, the flow of our sensory experience is being categorized and distinguished into clearly delineated objects. It's a little bit like freezing this flow into solid things that we can somehow then do something with them. So we permanently categorize our experience, and we do it so much so that we are not aware of this process most of the time. And then it can easily happen that the words and concepts acquire their own reality, and we lose contact with our actual experience. So we see a tree and know immediately, oh, tree. And often we do not look more closely, yeah? Because we think we have already grasped what there is to see. Just labeling it, putting it into a box, gives us the feeling, oh, I've seen it. Oh, yeah, yeah, I know a tree, but I do not actually see the leaves and the branches and all the colors, the shades. I'm just with the concept. So sanya creates the world in which we live. It's a world of fixed and well-defined objects in this function of dividing and interpreting the world. Any perception we have is always constructed on the basis of our previous experience and our previous ideas and knowledge. And again, also with regard to this aggregate, there can be so much clinging. The most powerful concept that determines and shapes our whole experience is probably the concept of the self. It's a sanya. Self is a sanya. One of the first words we learned as babies was our name. And just having this concept of me being this organism called yukha will create a certain solidity. If someone asks us who we are, it's very likely that we say first, okay, my name is yukha, isn't it? It's the first way how we introduce each other to each other. So we define ourselves by a name, which, if you think about it, was actually assigned to us rather arbitrarily. You know, our parents didn't know us really. Most of them decide before they have the children. I don't know, maybe it's different in Finland, but I think most parents, they already have an idea of the name they want to give to their child. And then even more, we have words like me or mine. So it's also built in our language that there is such a self. So we can realize that the world of things, of objects, is only seemingly so real because through Sanya, through this perception and conception, we interpret things in a certain way. And we can start to notice that this way of seeing is maybe just one possible view of seeing, and that there can be very different views, especially when we are communicating with other people who might have very different views. It's all just about having different sanya. Then we have the sankhara khanda, mental formations. This so-called mental formation group refers to emotions, intentions, volitions, all these processes when we are moved or inclined to do something. And it is actually a very comprehensive aggregate because it comprises virtually all of the mental factors that one usually distinguishes in Buddhist psychology, except for the three mental factors that we have listed separately as a khanda. So feeling, tone, vedana, perception, and then the next one, vijnana, consciousness. Those three are not part of the sankhara khanda. But all the other mental factors are subsumed in this mental formation group, like attention or interest or joy or loving kindness. It's all part of this. And this aggregate is particularly relevant because of its karmic power. It is here that the mind does not just receive and interpret sense data, but where it actually acts and reacts, and thereby planting karmic seeds that will grow and manifest in some way. The traditional image for sankhara is the image of a potter making pots. So it's really the place where we create. And we do this moment by moment, and very often on the basis of habit patterns, of conditionings, of tendencies in our being. Of course, this activity cannot really be separated from the other processes. It's always intertwined with all of them. They are always working together moment by moment. For instance, if you feel some bodily discomfort while sitting, then there is, of course, the rupa khanda, just this physical experience of sitting. Then there is the vedana of unpleasantness. There is the perception of identifying this as pain. This is pain. And the mental formation that might arise could be maybe some aversion. I don't like this, or I have to do something about this pain. Or maybe your mind reacts with equanimity and is actually quite at ease. Whatever, the mind can react in many different ways, but it's all sankhara. Actually, because this group includes habit patterns, we could also say that what we normally call a personality is nothing else than the specific patterns of our sankharas, or a bundle of disposition, as John Peacock calls it. Some people are rather shy and reserved. Others are rather outgoing or very dominant or joyful, whatever. And these are just manifestations of these mental formations that have evolved over time, over the years. And we easily, very easily identify with those patterns. And then we say things like, well, I am a shy person. Or, I am very outgoing. And by identifying with them, again, we see the same thing happening. We solidify them even more, and we lock ourselves into these habit patterns. What I find interesting is how the environment actually conditions very much the arising and the development of such sankharas. So we again see the conditionality of them, that they are not so fixed, for better or for worse, actually. For instance, when I'm with my mother, I find myself sometimes triggered to feel in ways that are deeply conditioned for my childhood, falling back into very old patterns. Maybe you know that. And it's incredible just to see the power of such conditionings to trigger some behavior or some feeling that I don't see when I'm with other people in other environments. Or when I'm moving into a new environment and I get to meet new people, there is like a feeling of freedom because they don't know me. And so there is like more freedom to maybe develop new sankharas. Do you know that, this feeling? And even if we cannot change those mental formations from one day to the next, we can fundamentally shape them over time. And Buddhist practice is so much about precisely this, about cultivating those mental formations so that we cultivate the more wholesome mental formations that lead to more peace, to more contentment, to more joy. It is through the practice of mindfulness that we start to recognize more clearly in every moment which sankhara is at work right now. So we can simply recognize, oh, here you are again, this feeling of loneliness or the feeling of irritation or dependency or ambition, whatever. This feeling that I've known for so long already. They're really old friends in a way. We can simply acknowledge and embrace them with kindness and understanding. And already by just consciously recognizing them, a little space is created, a little, you know, distance from it. And we discover maybe a way of dealing with them in a more skillful way. And this is real freedom, not to have to react in a certain way, but to learn that we can have a choice with regard to those sankharas. And even more basic is not just to see them, but then even not to identify so much with them anymore. Not to take them so personally anymore. Mental formations arise due to impersonal causes and conditions, our biography, everything that we've experienced, and nobody tells us that we should appropriate them. I mean, nobody has asked us whether we want these experiences. We were just, you know, exposed and then certain sankharas developed. And why should we make them who we are, who we define ourselves to be? So if there is a feeling of shyness, there is shyness. I do not need to make it my shyness. If there is desire, there is desire. It's not my desire. Whatever arises in the mind is simply an empty inclination coming from many conditions, and it simply can be known for what it is. Then the Vijnana Khanda is the fifth group, the consciousness group, which refers to the cognizing capacity of the mind, to the capacity to have conscious experience, to be aware. And I find it so interesting that somehow consciousness seems so self-evident to us. We all know that there is conscious experience, and yet at the same time it is utterly beyond conceptual description in a way. So consciousness, we could say, has to do with our ability to be aware, to know, to cognize. Regardless of what the object of our attention is, there is always this fundamental awareness, knowing the experience. In any moment, you can become aware of this dimension of your experience. Actually, using the word consciousness is a little bit dangerous because it suggests that we are talking about a thing existing in, you know, in a deeper sense. But actually, when we look into our experience, we cannot really pinpoint consciousness. We cannot locate it in any place or define it in terms of its color or its shape. And yet, we still know there is this quality of being aware, of knowing, and it's something we start to recognize more and more through our meditation experience. Actually, without mind training, without meditation, most people are not so aware of this consciousness because it's always wrapped up with the objects. Because consciousness is always consciousness of something, some experience. And most of the time we are so engrossed in the objects of our attention that we don't notice the knowing, this awareness dimension. The kanda of consciousness of vijnana primarily refers to sense consciousness. So our ability to have experiences of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and thinking. The five sense consciousness are very direct and simple, and they are each one specific to their respective senses. So the hearing consciousness detects all the hearing impressions, sounds, for instance. The sixth consciousness is directed to mental experiences, to thoughts or ideas. And again, also this kanda can become the basis for a sense of self, and actually a very convincing one. Doesn't it feel like I am seeing, I am hearing? This perception of me being the subject of my experience to which all experience happens, it's so compelling. Sometimes you hear people talk about being the witness, you know, in meditation, and there can actually be a sense at times that I really am consciousness, I am awareness, I am the knowing. But we need to see that also this is a construction, it's a fabrication if we define the self through the awareness. So this can be like the last bastion of the sense of self, even if we have seen through the identification with the body, we know, okay, I'm not my body, I'm not Vedana, I'm not the Sankharas. Somehow this sense that I am consciousness, I'm awareness, is not so easy to let go and to see through. We can just maybe remember, okay, this too, I am not, this is not mine. It's just awareness happening. It's just experience that is being known right now. So, we have gone through all the khandhas, and maybe you have got a sense of how our mind can grasp at any of them and create a self on the basis of them. And I would like to mention now just a few ways of practicing with this framework in our meditation. So I really would like to say that this teaching is just a framework. It's one way of conceiving our experience that is radically different from the conventional way we think about ourselves. We do not need to quarrel and say, now this is the ultimate and only truth about how things are. It's just an alternative way of seeing ourselves and the world. And the Buddha, through this, offered us a very helpful way of conceiving of ourselves, of relating to our experience, a framework that can really help us to free ourselves from our normal prison of identification. Even if these khandhas or aggregates might sound pretty abstract at the beginning, if we start to engage with this framework, if we just hear about it, we might notice how it can affect the way we relate to our bodies and to our minds. It can really profoundly loosen the normal sense of self and identity and open up more ease and well-being for us. It is, as Robert Bia would call it, a way of seeing that frees. So one way of working with this framework of the khandhas is by identifying them in our own experience. So really applying those concepts to our experience. Like if you are aware of your physical experience of softness, of hardness, of temperature, of smelling, of whatever, you can bring this framework to your experience and recognize, oh, right, this is Rupa. This is Rupa. Or you might recognize that the unpleasantness in your experience is just Vedana. So rather than framing all our experience as a personal experience, my pain in my chest, we can choose to see our experiences in terms of the aggregates and softly just bring this view to our experience. And this can soften our normal identification with our experience and investigate them with less self-identification. So you might just try in your meditation when you experience something to label it in terms of the aggregate, just to recognize, oh yeah, Vedana, ah yeah, Rupa, oh, Sankhara, active. So rather than going into the story about me and my history and what it all means and what the implications are for my future. So just deconstructing the experience into the five khandhas. A second possibility is to investigate the nature of the aggregates themselves so that we get in touch with their insubstantiality and emptiness. It is so helpful and eye-opening when we observe the khandhas with sustained attention over time so that more and more we get a sense how fleeting and changing they are. I find it again and again just so amazing to see how mind states change over the course of even very short periods of times. Just a few days last week, I was on my way to a meeting in town and I decided to buy a coffee just next to the bus stop. And then I noticed that it took more time than I had expected. And it, you know, it said 4 minutes and 3 minutes until the bus would arrive. And I was just noticing that I was standing in the line waiting for my coffee and just feeling how second by second the nervousness and the impatience was growing in my whole body. And there was even a kind of hostility towards this woman there doing the coffee because I said, yeah, she could really hurry up a little bit. It was a whole, I mean, it was a really insignificant event, but it involved a whole, all the five khandhas, all khandhas were involved in this very insignificant waiting for my coffee. And in the moment where I actually got my coffee and just was able to jump on the bus in the last minute, all the tension dropped again. It's really insignificant, but we can just become aware how sensitive we also are, how these events impact our whole being. It's so interesting also on retreat just to witness the whole stream of experience over time, this dynamic of sensations and impulses and reactions. None of the khandhas stays the same. They are all constantly changing and thus they are completely empty of a solid reality, of a solid nature. So the Buddha taught that we should really investigate into all the khandhas, so we start to perceive this insubstantiality and emptiness. And if, for instance, we investigate into the experience of our body, it can actually be in meditation at times that we notice how the experience can become less substantial. So maybe you have experienced how the body perception can change in meditation, how it can become less substantial. There is more a sense of just vibrating energy, or it fades a little bit. It can really change very much. And this gives us a sense that all our experiences are less solid than we usually believe them to be. And of course, this holds for all the khandhas, for emotions, for thoughts, for feeling. The less identification there is with them, the less clinging, the less solidifying, the lighter they become, and we really just see them as fleeting phenomena in a passing show. And we understand intuitively that none of those khandhas is really a reliable foundation for a sense of self. Another way how we can practice with this framework is by observing and contemplating how we are conceiving of the self with respect to the aggregates. So the Buddha pointed out four basic ways how a sense of self is being constructed, and we can go through them using the body as example. The first possibility is to identify the self with a khandha, with the body, thus saying, I am my body. The problem is that as we see the unstable and changing nature of the body, we realize, okay, maybe the body is not really such a good foundation for myself. The second possibility is a relationship of ownership. So I possess the body, or I possess Vedana, and so on. The self is somehow conceived to be separate and possessing any of the khandhas. Also, this will not hold up to scrutiny if we investigate it. A third possibility is to conceive of the body in the self. So somehow the self is seen as bigger, a bigger container containing the aggregates. And then the question is, well, what is it then? What would, you know, what would this self be, this bigger self? And the fourth possibility is to say that the self is within the body or within any of the khandhas. Again, here, I cannot go into the details, but if we investigate, we will find that we cannot find a self in any of those ways. Actually, one of you mentioned in an interview how she felt that someone was intruding her personal space on retreat here, and how this triggered a lot of reactivity. And so it's really great if we notice any kind of identification, any way how the mind perceives a sense of self. Even, of course, if this is a very unpleasant experience, it's actually great to have such experiences on retreat and to really be aware how in this moment there is identification in one of those four ways. My space, this is my space, and someone is intruding into my space, and just seeing the whole reactivity coming from it. So we can start to notice in our experience when there is identification, when you come in and someone is sitting on your cushion or on your chair, just notice the contraction, this myness, it's my cushion, my meditation experience. How is my meditation progress? How is my illness, my professional status, just being aware of identification when it happens? I find it really interesting how we can see how the sense of self changes. If we investigate, we see how it's not at all solid, because it's constantly finding a new base to define itself. This is from Tanisa Rowe. The sense of me and mine is rarely static. It roams like an amoeba, changing its contours as it changes location. Sometimes expansive, sometimes contracted. It can view itself as identical with a khanda, as possessing a khanda, as existing within a khanda, or as having a khanda existing within itself. At times feeling finite, at other times infinite, whatever shape it takes, it's always unstable and insecure. So it's not a reliable way of finding a ground in this world. And actually, when we can let go of these identifications, so much more joy and ease can open up. I remember once on retreat at IMS, when I was very caught in an emotional drama and the mind was ruminating about my story, my childhood. I was having inner conversations on why I was feeling this way. So I was sitting there at lunch and I was just noticing all the thinking and the emotional pain. I was kind of mindful, and then suddenly something shifted and the sense of ownership disappeared. It was so interesting to see from one moment to the next how all those memories that had been on my mind lost their myness. They were simply memories, impersonal memories, and there was such a relief to recognize that I didn't have to carry those memories with me alone, that they were just memories, just stories, not more or less important than the stories of any other person. So in that very moment, there was a letting go of this clinging, this identification. And there was really a sense of peace and acceptance of everything that had happened. And just knowing that, in a way, I was free. I could take it up, this bundle, and in a conventional way, no, that's my story. But I didn't have to make it the essence of who I am. There was really a release in that. And maybe just as a side note, you may have noticed that this understanding didn't happen in a state of deep samadhi, but in the midst of emotional upheaval. I find that interesting, that wisdom can really come in at any moment when we are mindful, when we are interested, somehow a right balance, you know. It doesn't have to be, okay, first I have to go to the fourth jhana. It can really happen any time if we are present. A third possibility that I would like to mention is just simply sometimes bringing in this view of non-identification. Sometimes when we are caught, when we are struggling, it can be helpful just to drop in the words, not me, not mine, and just reminding ourselves of the impersonality of all experience. And then just noticing the release that can come from this. So personally, I have found this helpful at times, just to bring in a little bit of that. So this path can really help us to see through and let go of self-identifications that are not helpful and that can imprison us. It doesn't mean that when we let go, when we relax around identification, that we then fall into some void of nothingness or so. Rather, what happens is that our sense of self becomes much more flexible. We still know who we are on a conventional level right now, and yet we learn how to hold this identity very lightly, knowing that it does change constantly, knowing that we can grow out of old identities, and that there is a freedom of developing and creating new ways of being, new ways of seeing, of acting, far beyond of what we considered possible for us. So I would like to end with a short quote by Pema Chodron. She's an American teacher. In the most ordinary terms, egolessness is a flexible identity. It manifests as inquisitiveness, as adaptability, as humor, as playfulness. It is our capacity to relax with not knowing, not figuring everything out, with not being at all sure about who we are or who anyone else is either. So let's sit for a moment.